The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, in a moment or two, you will hear a story. And it's a story that I hope will move you, and I hope it's a story that will motivate you. I was contacted by a guy called Owen Muzambi a couple of weeks ago. And then I happened to bump into Owen at a conference, and Owen told me an amazing story. And Owen is going to be the catalyst for something that we are going to do on The Money Show from tomorrow. So I'll tell you all about that this evening. We'll also get the updates on markets from Wayne McCurry today. A couple of interesting moves. Martin Ackerman, who is an economist at Citadel, all about the growth rate, which is pretty awful, frankly. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros, and he's been looking at political ad campaigns. And so far, he's just given zeros. I wonder if he'll be softened up at all as he looks at tonight's political party. Our Africa Business Report, and then crypto markets going through all kinds of interesting evolutions. Remember in the days of Bitcoin at $20,000, everybody wanted it. Now at, what is it, $3,000, $4,000, nobody wants a Bitcoin. But Marcus Swanepoel, South African homegrown, creating the Luno platform, and we'll talk to him all about that. But first, let's talk Nedbank results in just a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
I haven't presented you with a fast fact question for a while. So this is too good an opportunity to pass up. As any parent will know, Lego is the bane of any middle and upper income household. So I'd like to know from you this evening on 31702 and 31567, who has invented anti-Lego slippers? Serious question this evening. Somebody's invented anti-Lego slippers. 66 years Lego has been in the world, and nobody's done this yet. Somebody's invented anti-Lego slippers. It's a big one. 31702, 31567. Who has done that? Nedbank results for 2018, carried by EcoBank, the Togo-based banking group, which has been a drag on Nedbank for some time. But this year, just in time, coming to the party, Nedbank has got a 21% stake in EcoBank. And overall, Nedbank did grow profits 14.5%. South Africa, though, not doing too much to support that growth. It's been a tough year during 2018. Mike Brown is the Nedbank chief executive. Is it too much to say that the South African economy is dead? Maybe not dead, maybe it's dormant, maybe it's just asleep, maybe it needs a wake up. Well, what's your reading of the South African economy? Grew at 0.8% last year, which is below population growth. It's practically dead.
Yeah, I think growth remains probably the single largest challenge facing our economy. And, you know, I think for many of us, we knew that our country was in deep trouble a few years ago. We knew that our institutions were under pressure and our policies were simply not conducive to growth. But actually what we're finding out as we sit and listen to a number of commissions, Nugent, Zondo, et cetera, is that actually we were in a lot more trouble than even we thought at the time. And right now it feels like we're at the early stages of a very complicated political and institutional recovery. And until we get a couple of the big policy issues behind us, think Eskom, think land expropriation, you know, the elections this year, I think it's very difficult to see significantly improved confidence, investment, and therefore growth.
I mean, then more opportunities outside South Africa than inside South Africa. A lot of people have burnt their fingers on that philosophy, but it does seem to be the case. I mean, there are better growth opportunities elsewhere right now.
Yeah, so certainly for our business, we think about both. And while you rightly said in your introduction that our growth rate this year was supported by ETI or EcoBank, actually, if you look at the returns that ETI or EcoBank generates, those returns are still lower than we're able to generate in our South African market off the cost that we paid for that investment. So, you know, we're certainly still very focused on growth opportunities in South Africa, either through our corporate and wholesale businesses, where we do think that's going to be the start of growth in South Africa. If you look at our country, we know that consumers are under pressure. We know that the government's fiscal position is extremely stretched. So if growth is going to come from anywhere, it has to come from the corporate sector in South Africa. So we do expect some improvement in growth once we've got through these policy issues. And then we're pretty excited about the digital journey that our bank's been on for the last 5 or 6 years, and we're starting to get to produce some outcomes from that.
You may be excited about that, but while you're excited about what you're doing, there are a whole bunch of people sitting in the wings being very excited about what they're doing, whether that be Time Digital. They're through the Pick and Pay branches where you used to have Go Banking. You know how hard that is. That's a different business model, though. And you've got the guys at Bank Zero, Michael Jordan's group of ex-FNB bankers, thinking they can change the world. And then the big gorilla across the Santon from you in Discovery. I mean, they're coming at your market and at all of the upper echelons of the South African banking sector's markets quite aggressively.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think over time, the really big competitors in our market are going to be the big tech companies. I think they're going to make the guys here, you know, look relatively small in that regard. You know, that said, you know, I think that the incumbents, if they are appropriately focused on their own technology strategies, which are really only there to give their customers a better service at a better price point at the end of the day, the incumbents certainly have enormous benefits of incumbency. In our business, one, for example, would be that, you know, we're currently spending about 2 billion rand a year on new technology. So we have the ability, given our existing infrastructure, customer base, to be able to fund that sort of investment in technology. And we really do believe that investment in technology will create a customer experience that's going to be really hard for some of the smaller guys to replicate at scale.
How many branches do you have right now? 500-ish?
604.
604, exactly, on the nose. And do you think you'll have more than 604 branches 10 years from now at Nedbank? I mean, we look at the evolution of banking, and you talk about the digital journey and the big investments you're putting into digital. It seems logical that banks of the future will look more like a computer mainframe than a great big cream-colored building in the middle of Sandton.
So I think certainly if you're looking at European banks, that may well be the case. But given the curious mix in South Africa of developed and emerging markets, we currently think that our points of presence will remain roughly around that 600. It's actually shrunk from just over 700 probably about 3 or 4 years ago. So we have already reduced the infrastructure. But what's actually happening is the size of each branch is reducing. As those branches become more digital, they are more sales and service points. So our square meterage will reduce quite significantly, but our points of presence should remain roughly the same.
It's very clear that the second half of last year was better than the first half of last year. Is 2019 shaping up to be a better year than 2018 was? I mean, when he took over as president, Cyril Ramaphosa was talking about 3% growth in 2018. 0.8. We constantly, I think, National Treasury likes to overestimate its growth targets, overestimate tax collections, and we constantly undershoot, which is a concern.
Yeah, certainly. You know, our belief is that 2019 will be better than 2018, but only marginally so. Our current forecasts for GDP growth in the period ahead is 1.3%. So that's better than 0.8, but it's still way too low.
But that's only keeping up with population growth. I mean, that's all that is. I mean, in real terms, we've actually been in a decade-long recession. We haven't beaten population growth roughly over that period.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, it is obvious we've done enormous damage to our economy and institutions over the last 10 years. And a turnaround from that situation is certainly not an overnight occurrence.
Can we hold on to our investment rating, our investment grade rating? Moody's has got us one and a bit notches, just above junk. They've got us on a neutral outlook. They can take us down to a negative at the end of this month. Could we go into full-blown downgrade mode? It would seem unjust, but not unexpected.
Yeah, I think it would be unjust, and our current reading would be unlikely. You know, I think what the rating agencies will have to balance is, on the downside, it's clear from listening to the budget that fiscal deficits are worse than we previously thought and debt to GDP ratios are worse than we previously thought. So there's very definitely been fiscal weakness. But on the more positive side, although we haven't yet completed what we're going to do, it does seem like we are going to take very real steps to fix some of the very problematic state-owned enterprises that for many years we've quite frankly just kicked the can down the road. So I think on the other hand, they will look at those positive steps, and over the longer term, if we're able to take them, then I do believe we will be able to escape falling below sub-investment grade.
Mike Brown, Chief Executive of Nedbank this evening. And I was telling you earlier, I was at a conference. A guy came up to me and told me an incredible story that he'd emailed me about just a couple of days before. And he told me how The Money Show had changed his life. And his story has motivated us to start a brand new feature. And that's going to be launched tomorrow. And whatever you do, stop. Just stop doing what, not driving. Don't stop driving. You've got to keep your eyes on the road, but concentrate on the road and listen at the same time. Because maybe you need a break. Maybe someone you know needs a break. Maybe you're someone who can give a break. And we're looking for people like Owen Umzambi, who need a break. Not freeloaders, not chancers, not opportunists. People who genuinely need a break and will use the platform that we provide to improve not only their own lives, but the lives of others as well. So we're launching The Money Show's Big Break. We've got a colleague who has read Owen's email. Take a listen, and then I'll tell you how it's going to work.
Hi, Bruce. I wanted to share with you how you helped me transition into business. I tried to capture everything in this timeline. In 2009, I was homeless and partly lived in a park in West Dean called Kingston Frost Park. My prized possession was a phone which had an FM radio. I charged it daily to listen to 702. I liked all the shows, but your show was the most fascinating. I called it my business school. I sold cigarettes and mints and tried to apply your principles. In 2009 to 2011, I did several odd jobs as a casual worker, security guarding, truck loading, and carpentry. I kept listening to your show throughout. In 2011, I was encouraged to start a proper business. I started an informal handyman company focusing on general repair work. In April of that year, there was a protracted picket-up strike. I hired a bucky and sent you an email offering to be a solution for desperate households. You tweeted the email and a flood of calls came through. In 2011 to 2013, I collected rubbish from the different households, but after the strike, the listeners became a pipeline for my handyman business. In 2013, a listener heard about the Awetu project on the radio, probably your show, and shared the information. I joined the incubator, and the rest is history. Today, I am the chief executive of a development consultancy called Driven. We focus on inclusive development, mainly economic and financial inclusion, and lately also disability inclusion with special needs children in peri-urban townships. We are a 10-man team with an office in Rosebank. On 12 April 2019, we will celebrate 5 years as an entity. It'll be 8 years since I sent you the email and 10 years of listening to your show. I have moved from selling cigarettes for 90 cents each to discussing financial inclusion interventions for entire communities with budgets that run into millions. Warm regards, Owen Umzambi.
So Owen is with us and he'll join me in half an hour's time. You'll hear from him directly and personally. But that motivated us to say, hold on a second. Here's a guy who utilized access to information that we provide to you every single day and grabbed the opportunity and then was able to leverage that opportunity for himself. And my thanks to Mohale Moloi, who voiced that email, long for me to read directly to you. You hear enough of my voice as it is. But we'll chat to Owen in person. We want you, if you need a break, to get in touch. And we anticipate that we will get a big response. So we've created a way for you to do it. You can either email me. And if you email me or the comment line, I will delete your email. You can't email me. Don't email me because I will just delete the mail and it'll disappear. What we've done is on our website, 702.co.za and capetalk.co.za, we've got an online form. It's the Money Show Big Break online form. It'll ask who you are, what you do, what you need. And every week we will showcase one person. It's a bit starfish principle. We can't help everybody. We can't solve the world's problems. But we might be able to help you, or you might be able to help somebody else. Money Show's Big Break. It's launching tomorrow. Look out for that on our website. We'll talk to Owen in some detail in a bit.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Wayne McCurry with Wealth and Investments at FNB. I mean, just considering how weak all the retail trading updates have been, perhaps we should have been grateful to get any growth at all. Growth of 0.8% last year, Wayne.
When you have a look at the last quarter results, let's call it the private consumption part wasn't bad. And yet, as you said, the trading updates are actually quite weak. But I mean, obviously, Bruce, we know all of the background to our low economic growth rate. The numbers were slightly better than anticipated, but only slightly.
Oh, yawn. Yeah.
And it's that point. And, you know, to the one positive about having a terrible last 10 years is that there is some ability to spend money, because credit creations hasn't been that massive. People are not over indebted, but it needs a sentiment change. And to get a sentiment change, you've got to see positive political and structural change.
Mike Brown in here a moment ago doing his best to sort of say they're seeing the early stages of it.
It's looking a bit better.
They don't expect it to come from the from individuals just yet, but certainly they're expecting to see a turnaround. When it does come, will come out of the corporate sector, and it'll be led by government, and corporate sector is going to have to fulfill.
Yeah. Look, I have a slightly different view. I think corporate sector actually fundamentally reacts to consumer demand. They're not going to spend money if they don't see demand. Mm. But you can change sentiment very quickly and actually generate a bit of demand out there.
We certainly hope so. What did you think of those Nedbank results? I mean, it was a tough year, tough set of numbers.
Well, look, Ecobank is the big turnaround factor. We know that it was about a 1.6, 1.7 billion rand turnover from a loss to a profit. But if you exclude that and just look at South Africa, the earnings growth from South African operations is, call it 3-4%. It's actually very, very low. Now, none of the banks are going to show double digits, you know, from their South African operations. So it's very much the same for Nedbank as in other financial institutions. But certainly, you know, when you look at the ratings of the shares, you know, they 10, 11, 12 price earnings ratio shares, which is actually quite low. And if we get 1.3% this year or 1.7% this year, I mean, it's still inadequate, but it's certainly better than 0.8 or 0.7. Yeah. So it all helps. All of these things help.
Yeah, I mean, and Nedbank looks like positioning itself quite interestingly, looking to get market share, getting deposits into accounts. So when growth does come, if growth does come, when it comes,
it'll be well positioned. And of course, all the banks are fully capitalized. They don't need any more money. They're not short on capital to supply credit out into the market. They're just waiting for demand.
Yeah.
And the environment is more certain. We must remember where we were a year ago.
No, it's hard to forget. It's hard to remember. Sorry, it's easy to forget.
Yeah. When you just look at how many changes have already been made in the management of the government, the country, SOEs. I mean, there's still many, many more things to do. And you've got to see legislative changes and structural changes. Mm-hmm. But to say we've done nothing in a year is, in fact, completely incorrect.
That would be disingenuous.
Yeah, we've only just started on this process, and there's a massive road still to go. Mm-hmm. But a lot has already changed, because previously you used to hear every day when you turn on the radio stories of corruption. Now when you turn on the radio every day, you hear the stories being revealed in numerous numbers of commissions.
Yeah.
And that will end up in criminal prosecution, and it will eventually get there somehow stage. And it will. I have full confidence that it will. Mm. So the whole atmosphere has changed.
That certainly is.
Obviously, that must be positive.
No, it has to be. Do we care about Clover results? I mean, they're delisting fairly soon. There is some opposition to them being taken out.
No, to be honest, you know, they it's a very difficult industry. They tried that business of spinning off the raw milk, and that didn't work. They had to bail it out. Look, delistings only happen where the buyer thinks it's a good time to buy. So automatically, as a current shareholder, if you're going to delist, you should automatically say, I want more.
Yes.
Because they're not buying it if they think it's too expensive. Make no mistake about that. They're saying, no, you're buying it at a good point in the cycle. But that's capitalism. You must hang out for as much as what you can get, I suppose. But the results, no, it's not really of interest to market participants.
And then there was Resilient and Fortress. Yes. They had two separate announcements today. Both share prices went up. These are part of the same family of property companies, the REITs sector. What is going on between those two?
No, Resilient's buying back their shares. Remember, they unbundled the Fortress shares. Yes. A year ago, somewhere around there, they are now buying back their shares, but they're doing it by selling properties to Fortress for 3 billion, buying back 600 million, and giving them enough cash to actually buy back their own shares. And they're also buying another company I haven't heard of now. They're also buying a bigger increase, but I think it's a relatively small company.
Does this sort of sort out governance issues around Resilient and Fortress? There are lots of cross-holdings, and it's been very messy.
It helps the cross-holding story, but we still got to see the results of all the investigations.
Yeah, most certainly.
We've got to wait for that.
And yeah, and we're also waiting for Steinhoff. Lots of rumblings that we're going to get Steinhoff outcomes, and Steinhoff is going to be pursued. It's getting close.
If we're both still around in 10 years' time, we'll still be talking about Steinhoff. But at least we hope to see something in the next 3 months. The forensic report, the annual financial statements for 2 years, the criminal prosecution, more news, more exposures about what happened there. I mean, it all will be very interesting to watch, but I don't think it's going to help the share price.
No, it's not going to help the share price, but we need to go. Corporate South Africa needs to be seen to be held accountable for its malfeasance.
There's got to be a cleansing.
Yeah, we can't whinge about the public sector, and we can't whinge about the ESCOMs if we're not going to see private sector South Africa also get clapped when it's deserved.
Yes.
Wayne McCurry, he is with Wealth and Investments at FNB.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
So earlier, I asked you, who has invented anti-Lego slippers? The answer is Lego. After 66 years of torturing parents of small children in the middle of the night as they go caringly and gently and quietly into the bedrooms of their children to make sure they haven't fallen out of bed or stopped breathing or whatever it is their parents worry about when they go and check on their children. And then you step, and you can't shout, you can't scream, and you certainly can't swear as much as you would like to as you stand on that infernal piece of Lego. You can't do it. So after 66 excruciating years, Lego, which has been answering the dreams of children and dealing with parents' worst nightmare, is now going to be inventing Lego slippers. Now, will they give you a free pair of Lego slippers every time you buy a box of Lego? Will that be another extra? Oh, it's going to be another extra because they're good at making money. They're almost as good as making money as they are at making Lego. The Money Show, offering valuable airtime, the attention of influential listeners to anyone who has a good story. We're calling it the Money Show Big Break. Every Wednesday, we're going to give some radio airtime to somebody who needs help, an opportunity to kickstart, make their dreams come true. We offer you the airtime. You do the work. You must send us your pitch and inspire us to be chosen for the Money Show Big Break. You'll find the entry form on the Money Show page on the 702 and Cape Talk websites. Do that if you need a big break. We'll talk about it next time on the Money Show.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
We'll talk more about the big break, the Money Show big break, in a couple of minutes' time when we talk to the instigator. I want to call him the instigator, Owen Muzambi. He is the chief executive of Driven Entrepreneurs, and he's a lovely guy, and I'm looking forward to welcoming him into the Money Show studio in just a few minutes' time. We'll talk to Owen find out what he's up to. Find out what he's doing. If you want to talk about GDP and the economy, if you want to talk about the state of the nation, you're welcome to give us a call on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. I've loved your responses on social media this evening to Owen's story, which we had Mohale in our Cape Town studio. He read Owen's email to us. We thought it'd be better than me reading it. But my favorite response, thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Terrence, and thank you everyone else who's responded this evening. Nashira Davids on Twitter says, I just had a makeup mudslide in my car. I heard Owen's story, such an inspiration. Owen is in studio with us this evening. You're making people cry in their cars, Owen.
I don't know what to say. That's definitely not the intention.
I mean, your story is so typical of so many South Africans who found themselves in hard times, and you just refused to take no for an answer. You refused to become a victim of your circumstances, and you lived hard but grabbed opportunities as they came your way.
Yeah, that's true, Bruce. I think what that first situation helped in me was develop a transformation of my own self and transformation of my own my concept of myself, and this is what I mean. When you are living in a park, and some of the choices you need to make between should I pick up that food or should I sleep in this edge of the park that is a bit safe, you know, it kind of strips away all the kind of ego that you might have as an individual, right? And that stripping away of ego becomes like a fertile ground for positive self-development.
Or it breaks you. I mean, many people are broken by living rough. I mean, because a lot of people don't see hope. How did you see hope in that scenario?
I don't know what, you know, the response to that question would be, but I definitely, it was the process of just, you know, first definitely breaking you down. I'm not going to say it was an easy sort of like road,
no.
But after having been broken down, you realize, you know what, maybe I should leave victimhood or the sense of entitlement and begin the process of agency itself, sort of self-drive. And that manifested in me first by beginning to sell cigarettes for within that area in Brixton, and from there, having accessed the talk radio and also your show, the next kind of phase was empowerment, but empowerment through information. There's something empowering about being a street vendor, but you are able to understand concepts like, you know, consumer index or consumer basket, or all those different concepts that you guys sort of like give commentary to and analyze. And that sort of like began the journey or the catalysis of what perhaps I can call my entrepreneurial intent at the time.
Yeah. And then you did a job that not everybody would choose as a first gig, and that is taking away other people's rubbish. But that gave you inroads into people's homes as a guy who could do some DIY. You did some DIY. You connected with your customers. You got to know your customers. They got to know you. Mm-hmm. They got to hear about Yusuf Rondera Rees and the Awetu project. And you got in touch, and Yusuf tells us you're a star.
All right. Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
Because we checked you out. You seem too good to be true, you see. No, but I mean, but you got involved with the Awetu project, and you've created now a business that employs people. I mean, 7 years later, you are running a business that employs people. Tell us about what you're doing right now.
Okay, cool. We've gone through, you know, a phase of a real evolution as a business. And I think having finished our first 5 years of existence, you know, we kind of at a place where we know exactly what our offering is and what our what we've got to offer to the market, and we describe ourselves as a development advisory or innovative development. I think I have to emphasize innovative because we're trying to really do development, but in a very different way. Development is rather very classical and traditional field, and trying to find ways of doing or changing people's lives in a very different and innovative way, using tech, and perhaps that's why you saw me at that conference, the banking conference. It was trying to explore how we could accelerate some of our work, financial inclusion in particular, but our focus is, like you say, curating the email economic inclusion, financial inclusion, and also disability inclusion, trying to use market mechanisms to change people's lives and to affect multidimensional poverty levels.
Give me a practical example of how you're doing it. I mean, just one particular case study, perhaps?
So I can mention one program we've been running for the last 2 years, and that's in partnership with the Assisa organization and the Assisa Foundation. So it's Ruth Benjamin Swells and Leon Kamfer. And there we're really developing financial capabilities in small businesses, informal, and also others at different levels. And the view there is, how do we help informal businesses understand the most basic concepts of personal finances and business finances? How do we empower them to build capabilities that help them manage their businesses very competently and effectively, beyond just where they are now? And I think we're exploring now going into further areas of financial inclusion, which is just not financial education, banking, you know, banking the unbanked, microcredit, and all those different other concepts.
Because you do know what you've done. Okay, so what you've done is that you have got us to launch a brand new feature on The Money Show, and we are looking for people like you. We can't help people. We're not capable of helping people. We don't have the skills. We don't have the ability. We don't have the time. But what we do have is listeners. And what we do have is airtime. And so tomorrow on The Money Show, the big break, The Money Show big break, and we're going to invite people to fill in a form on either the 702 or the Cape Talk website and to send it to us and say, this is why I deserve some airtime, because I need a big break. And we're going to amplify that big break desire. And some may work and some may fail. And some people may go, oh, good, I've done the work now. I don't have to do anything anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, what your story teaches us is the big breaks are great, but if you don't sweat it and if you don't work it as you have done, it's not going to work. I mean, it's all up to the individual to take that big break and run with it. And you've motivated us to provide the big break.
Yeah. If I can react to the first comment that you made. So yeah, you don't have the systems, you don't have the capability to help everybody. But I think you're doing it in ways that you might not actually know. Just accessing information, I think, is helping enough. Accessing all this knowledge, especially if you're not necessarily in an institutionalized sort of like space or platform in a school, just being able to listen to CEOs speak, listen to all these different commentaries, you know, is empowerment enough. And I think maybe people just might need to like recognize it as that. But on the second part, I think there is a level a level which individual agency will take you. But I think the other part also comes from getting support from other people. And I think that's what you guys did, right? Mm-hmm. So in 2011, perhaps the first sort of like inciting or inflection point where I knew I wanted to do this and the opportunity came through. But having to send emails to all the radio hosts, yourself, David O'Sullivan, Peter Delma, and all those guys gave me access to people that otherwise I would not have access had you not sort of like given me that access. So there is a balance, right, of individual agency, but also just help from other people.
And we can provide the help and we can provide the connections. Owen Wuzambi, you're a superstar and you've motivated us. Chief Executive at Driven Entrepreneurs, your motivation will change other people's lives.
Awesome. Great. Thanks.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Thursday night. Where do I find out, ask somebody, who the 239 companies are that Davi Root refers to in his talk at the Free Market Foundation? Well, I've got a couple of ideas on that. You could phone the Efficient Group and ask to speak to Davi Root. Or you could speak to the Free Market Foundation and ask them. I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that economic growth, however, last year came in at 0.8%, and that's disappointing. We had a pretty good fourth quarter relative to quarters one and two, where the economy got smaller. Martin Ackerman is chief economist and advisory partner at Citadel. We've spoken quite a lot about the economy today, Martin. I mean, are there signals of better things to come, the so-called green shoots, the phrase I hate most, more than anything else in the world?
Yes, good evening, Bruce. I think that we can either see the glass half full or half empty. The reality is that the numbers are still very soft. It's still way below the growth in population. So, in fact, the average person out there is getting poorer. And we need to get growth well above that before we can really start to create jobs and resolve a lot of the issues. But there are some green shoots. You know, we are leaving the recession behind, so that's a positive. Like you said, we are seeing that certain sectors like manufacturing had very good growth. That is important because that's one of the bigger job-creating sectors in the economy. So we would like to see more of that. You can probably add to that agriculture. But then there's still a concern around sectors like mining that's still not contributing whatsoever. Construction, you know, that we haven't seen a positive sector quarter in probably the last nine. And that's an indication of a lack of investments, which is also confirmed today by the fixed investment number that got down 2.5%. So while investors are still waiting to invest and looking for clarity in terms of policy, energy supply, resolving the ESCOM issue, we are going to struggle to actually move forward and get more sustainable growth in terms of beating at least the growth in population.
Yeah, I mean, look, we can sit and bemoan, I suppose, the macros as much as we like. But I just think off the top of my head of businesses that I know of that have started in the last 10 years, the so-called lost decade that South Africa has gone through. And I think of people that we profiled, for example, in our Solutionist Thinking series with RMB, the first series. We're going to the second series now. But amongst those, Spark Schools, which almost it started up. Its startup coincided with the start of the Great Recession. And yet this is a company which now educates 20,000 kids, employs 1,000 teachers, has got 21 campuses, and it grew in the most hostile and negative environment. Sometimes great businesses can grow in negative environments, just the right business at the right time, fulfilling the right sort of need. We can get ourselves all caught up in the negative macroeconomic outlook, or we can just find better places to put our money and better places to invest. And there are growth areas in this economy, surely, Martin.
No, for sure. I think, you know, the one thing about our economy, even including the last decade, is that we've got pockets of excellence. And if you can identify that, you know, that part of the market is 100% ready for the private sector. And also, we know that the private sector, given the right incentives and policies and focus, can probably resolve all the issues we are facing at this point in time. And that's why it's so important that government and private sector is getting closer to each other again. And we are seeing that, you know, the new administration is definitely pushing in that direction. A great example is the mining endowment, where the general feedback was that in the past 10 months, they've engaged with government, the private sector, mining, private sector engaged with government probably 20 times more compared to the last decades. And then, like last week, then Vendata opened the new zinc mine in Northern Cape with the potential of another major smelter going up there. So these pockets of excellence are definitely there to be found, and I fully agree with you to get only concerned or negative rather on some of the numbers. You know, it took us 10 years to get here. It will take a bit of time to actually get out of this shaker. But I think we are heading in the right direction with the policy that's in the pipeline.
Martin Ackerman, thank you. Chief Economist at Citadel.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening, Heroes and Zeros, with Andy Rice, our Africa Business Report. What now for Nigeria, that Bushiri's won the election? Where do they go to next? They've had a distinctly uneventful first part of his presidency. They go into a second part. If he remains healthy, will it make the slightest bit of difference? Has he got what it takes to turn around a country with so much potential, which is sitting on one of the world's most sought-after commodities? It can't even refine its own fuel. I mean, it's one of those great tragedies, I suppose, of having being resource rich, but just not leveraging the opportunities nearly adequately enough. So, yes, we'll talk about that this evening, and then cryptocurrencies tonight. I still feel very shifty and uncomfortable at the cryptocurrency world, but that's making me old fashioned. We'll talk to somebody who is new fashioned in the world of cryptocurrencies, the chief executive of Luno, a South African by the name of Marcus Swanepoel, who's going to be joining us in studio at 7:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
So in Joburg, the M2 motorway is closed until October to do very urgent repairs. And I was in downtown Joburg yesterday. I went to the Absa Money Museum. Andy Rice, have you been to the Absa Money Museum?
I have indeed. Fascinating.
It's a fabulous place, and I've done an ENCA shoot for a show I do on ENCA called Taking Stock, and am I allowed to market my own TV show on radio? Too late, done it. Sorry, bad Bruce. I suspend myself for 3 seconds. Excellent. punishment taken like it and deserved. But getting stuck in downtown Joburg yesterday and then trying to get out of the APSA area.
No fun.
Oh, my goodness gracious me. Yeah. Fascinating and interesting and lots of pockets of brilliant excellence and pockets of absolute dilapidation. But what are they calling the fact that the roads are closed in that area?
Bruce, they're calling it road shedding.
It's lovely. I mean, if South Africans had a sense of humor about load shedding and road shedding, we could put a billboard to that effect and say, terribly sorry about the road shedding, but I just think it would lead to road wage and make us even more angry than we are as we get stuck in traffic. And it's just so indescribable. So many SMSs this evening talking about traffic jams all over downtown Joburg as we try and navigate that part of town. But without the repairs, the bridge collapses, people die, and it'll take even longer to repair. You've done political advertising. You've been quite critical of political ad campaigns so far of the Democratic Alliance and the
yep.
ANC, if memory serves. You've given both.
COPE.
COPE. I think not the ANC. So you haven't looked at the ANC yet. But COPE you gave a zero to. You gave the DA a zero. And tonight it is the turn of the EFF.
The EFF, yes. Brand EFF. What do we know about that? Well, only a little over 5 years old and already with 25 seats in Parliament, but I think we should put that into perspective. That's one-tenth of the number of seats that the ANC have got, and even the DA has 3.5 times as many seats. But when you start to look at the impact they've had from a communication perspective, as well as from a political perspective, then you might well start to believe that in a rather unfortunate metaphor, perhaps, that they are punching above their weight. Certainly, they are doing a lot of things right when it comes to building a brand. And I hasten to add that at no stage am I going to be in any way condoning what the content is, or supporting or denying it. But you have to say that when you look at the attributes of strong brands, when you look at the things that indicate to marketers that a brand has potential, you find that a lot of boxes get ticked for the EFF. Clearly, they understand the power of publicity, the power of hijacking issues for their own benefit. So that kind of opportunist guerrilla marketing is there. Perhaps most important of all, they have a simple, memorable theme slogan, just five words: our land and jobs now. And if you think about those five words, four of them have such rich stuff behind them. So our, that immediately starts with the whole thing of ownership. Land and jobs, the two hottest issues for their constituents. Now, fed up with waiting 25 years. So there, I don't know who wrote that line or even whether it was written by anybody, but there's just five words there. And at last, it's a political slogan that doesn't fall back on kind of the academia world of socio-political discourse. You know, they managed to find something that resonates.
But it's also a direct message. I mean, it's not about change or fight back.
Yep.
Or slant the rach, as I was driving through Kempton Park the other day on a Freedom Front poster. It's aspirational. It is demanding. It is on point and to the point, and fits in holistically with the brand. I mean, if there's one political party knows what it is and what it stands for and has a message that it is very clear about, it may or may not have the electorate, but certainly it knows itself.
Absolutely, Bruce, and it's making waves even more. I mean, we looked at the right at the beginning at the relative size of the brand or the party against the ANC as measured in seats in Parliament. Yet, in terms of followers on Twitter, it goes from being one tenth the size of the ANC to substantially larger than the ANC in terms of number of Twitter followers, 700,000 versus 600,000, and almost as many on Facebook. Although there, the ANC does have the slight edge. So they are getting through to their electorate as well, on the assumption that many of the younger members of the electorate are digital savvy and are looking at things on social media. They understand the power of personality. You know, again, Julius Malema, personality is strong. You can have your own views about which direction it leads you in, but it's strong. And I think if you were to compare it with the very sort of urbane Mamoussi Maimane, you'll find that in terms of strength of personality, we know who's winning that one. They understand the power of visual impact and of colour. You know, the red of the EFF stands out everywhere, and of tone. They're consistently confrontational. So in many ways, they have distinctive, disruptive attributes to their brand. The big question, of course, is one of fulfillment. A brand is not just a promise made, but it's a promise kept as well. And time will tell whether the many things that people have picked out from their manifesto that seem to be utterly unachievable.
I mean, look, the manifesto, if one believed the manifesto, then it would be a slam dunk. They'd get 100% of the votes. The electorate would be behind them. And then and South Africa would be paradise forevermore. The manifesto wasn't realistic, but that's a value judgment. In terms of brand presence, brand and understanding their market and delivering to the brand promise to that market, they've got to get a hero, surely.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There are times when their disruptive tactics tip over into something a little worse, but there's no doubt that in terms of a marketer's view of little brands, the EFF is absolutely heroic.
Let us then do your zero, please.
Well, sometimes on a Tuesday morning, I wake up and I think, oh, my goodness me, I've got nothing to trash. I haven't got anybody who's really standing up and saying, look at me, until into my email inbox came a wonderful piece of communication. And it's for a cognac brand. So imagine a French upmarket cognac brand. And they've apparently tried to distill, see what I did there, the essence of the brand experience into a few lines of copy. And let me read it to you, Bruce, and see what you think. as you take your sip of this cognac. A wave of warmth grows, crests, and then breaks. The mouth is awash with the sensation of an immense roundness.
My mouth is awash with the taste of bile.
A robust presence,
sort of pre-puke.
Full and voluptuous is
no,
felt.
No, stop it, please. No, stop it.
One last sentence. Skydive through an aerial world in which flame is as soft as the touch of a cloud.
No, sorry.
The flame
skydive through an aerial world where the flame is what?
As soft as the touch of a cloud.
Oh,
ladies and gentlemen, we have our zero in spades this week. It is Hennessy Cognac for this kind of I don't know how to... Words aren't strong enough to describe it.
But they paid people money to come up with that drivel.
Presumably. And it's actually, frighteningly, only number four in a series of seven pieces of communication. The first three happily seem to have missed me, but if there are any more to come, I can only assume it's in the same genre.
But now these, 2 weeks ago, you were talking to us about Turkish Airlines, and
yep.
You were talking to us about how Ridley Scott has made this mini movie for Turkish Airlines, and I think it became your hero, because it was quite magnificent. Ridley Scott has made a mini movie for Hennessy, and I watched 37 seconds of it while retching into my waste paper basket next to my desk and disgusting my producer and colleagues around me, having read the drivel that you've just spouted. And I just couldn't watch the video anymore. It's just like, Ridley Scott, what have you done?
The video...
This is the guy who did Gladiator, for goodness sake.
Alien and lots of others.
Oh.
The video is very much the visual counterpart of this copy. It's in the same vein, and it is hard to get through, I have to say. It's just visual trickery from start to finish. And for a brand that is, whatever it is, 250 years old...
What makes great brands lose their way like this?
There must be some wonderful history they could have brought up to date and contemporized. But no, they chose to go this very weird and frankly pretentious route.
Okay, I'm going to stick my fingers in my ears, and I'm going to go quietly and read it again.
A wave of warmth grows, crests, and then breaks. The mouth is awash with the sensation of an immense roundness. A robust presence, full and voluptuous, is felt. Just my sensation after having a little cold castle. That's exactly what I feel. A sense of roundness.
Pompous
in my mouth.
Idiocy. Oh! If I ever was a brandy drinker, I would stop immediately. And they've just stopped me from starting.
There you go. The power of marketing to alienate as much as to attract.
Phew. Andy Rice, heroes and zeros. Hero this evening, the EFF's political brand, gets Andy Rice's hero status as a result of truly knowing itself, targeting its market, and being very consistent in the delivery of that brand and brand promise. And zero, Hennessy Cognac.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Our Africa Business Report this evening, Ronak Gopoulos. Ronak is director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk this evening. The Nigerian elections are over, Ronak Gopoulos. And the results, not a foregone conclusion by any stretch of the imagination, but Nigeria gets more of the same.
Yeah, it's looking that way. The presidential elections, and thus said, we know that the opposition candidate, Atiku Abubakar, is preparing a legal challenge to overturn the results, probably unlikely to succeed. But, you know, we said that before with Kenya, and we got a surprise announcement. So let's not count our chickens before they hatch. But, you know, assuming that the result is upheld, the big question then shifts to the economy and what to expect in a second term from President Buhari. We know he's kind of got a very strong anti-corruption stance, big on security. But the economic performance of the first term was uninspiring, to say the least. And he's not going to have the same honeymoon period that he did previously. So big focus is going to be on the economy, you know, at a time when most of Africa is kind of moving towards a more globalist approach in terms of the continental free trade agreement, greater regional cooperation, you know, less friction in terms of doing business and more cooperation. Nigeria has taken this very protectionist and insular approach. So we'll be watching that on a continental level. We'll be watching the relationship with the private sector. We know that there have been a few issues with businesses operating in the country, not only because of the macros, but because of the regulatory environment. MTN's issues are well documented. So now that he doesn't have to seek re-election for another term, is there going to be a more conciliatory stance, or is the same going to remain? So, and businesses that remain skittish as a result of this. But ultimately, I think he's a leopard that's unlikely to change his spots, and his ideas will remain the same. A more active role for the state, focus on agriculture, ethics and fuel price stability, hostility really to the market economy, and that will be the kind of continued trajectory for Nigeria.
I mean, he did have his out of office email on for the first half of his presidency the last time round. Is he going to be more present this time round? I mean, how's his health? It's got to have been a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we can just sit here and speculate at best. I think, you know, science suggests that he has been fit and active, but, you know, Nigeria's got precedent around succession of a president passing in office. And the vice president, in his absence, dealt with the economy quite deftly. So I don't think it's going to be as big an issue if he doesn't fulfill his term. Nigeria has been in this situation before.
Now, Mozambique, I mean, goes from moments of promise to moments of desperation. The promise of gas reserves and the promise that things are going to be better into the future. And Mozambique remains one of the world's poorest countries. It sits right here on our doorstep. I mean, is there a better outlook for Mozambique in 2019 than previously, or is it more of the same?
They've got a lot of issues to contend with in Mozambique this year. I mean, you know, apart from having an election later in the year, they're still dealing with the hangover from the hidden debt scandal, and that saga continues. You know, at the moment, the government still hasn't settled its arrears around the default on the Eurobond. Donors remain hawkish. The IMF remains on the sidelines because they were lied to. So Mozambique, from an economic perspective, has got a credibility gap that needs to be repaired. And to do that, there needs to be political accountability. If you're following the news around the former finance minister, Manuel Chang, he's currently, you know, awaiting trial in South Africa. And the big question mark is going to be around whether he's extradited to the U.S. For his role in the debt scandal or back to Mozambique. And, you know, that's unclear which way it's going to go, but I think you're more likely to see greater accountability if he is extradited to the U.S., but it seems that that South Africa is not that way inclined at the moment. So unless, you know, these kind of issues around accountability and credibility are sorted out from an economic perspective, Mozambique's economy will continue to remain extremely weak. But then, you know, they've got other issues as well. Of course, the Islamic terror threat in the country has been growing over the past couple of years. Recently, Anadarko's interests in the Cabo Delgado region were attacked, and this has kind of raised question marks around the LNG sector and whether this is going to pose a threat to that sector, which is generating a lot of excitement. You know, it's probably too early to tell that, and it's probably unlikely to dampen the optimism regarding new LNG ventures. But it's a space that we need to watch closely, because if it does escalate, then what is potentially touted as a game changer for the Mozambican economy could be compromised.
Are the Algerian protests worrying you? Do you feel like we're going for another Arab Spring here, or is it more noise than substance? What is your reading of it?
I mean, Friday is going to be the litmus test for Algeria. I mean, you know, this, like you said, this is a region that's experienced a lot of political change in the past few years. The president of Algeria is 82 years old. He's kind of half paralyzed, rarely seen in public, and half the country is under the age of 30. He's seeking a fifth term. So, you know, there's a massive disconnect between, you know, this Facebook versus this facelift generation and the massive generational gap. Algiers was brought to a standstill last week. The metro was shut down. The highway was closed. And Friday, when his candidacy is officially confirmed, is going to be key to see whether these protests are sustained, whether we get this kind of earthquake that we've seen in other countries. You know, the president has tried to pledge reform. He said that he won't finish his full term. He's pledged a new constitution and reform. But it seems that the protest action in Algeria remains robust and vigilant. So we're going to be watching with bated breath on Friday. But there does seem to be a lot of strong momentum for change. And we'll see how that plays out.
I mean, is it all about economic nationalism? Are we seeing this sort of spectre of economic nationalism beginning to rear its head on this continent?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you've got a dichotomy. On the one hand, you know, the continent is moving towards greater regional cooperation, reducing the cost of doing business, moving towards an easier business environment through the Continental Free Trade Agreement and a number of other initiatives on a pan-African level, or at least that's what the rhetoric suggests. But then you've got countries like Nigeria in the way that it's handled the MTN saga. You've got countries like Tanzania with Acacia Mining that have kind of levied punitive and draconian measures against soft targets in the private sector to extract both political and financial currency. So the rhetoric is not matching the actions on a domestic level within these countries. And, you know, I don't think this is just isolated to these two countries. You know, Uganda is expelling a whole bunch of foreign nationals and executives as well. And then from a global perspective, we've also seen the rise of, you know, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Jeremy Corbyn. And I think there's a lot of pent-up frustration with capitalism and a lack of inclusive growth, which means that kind of strong politicians who are seen to be corruption busters and who are kind of fighting the populist fight against the big bad wolf of global capitalism derive financial and political currency from it. So I think you know, there are some obvious examples, but it is something that we're keeping an eye on quite closely. And I do think in various parts of the continent, economic nationalism is on the up.
My thanks to Ronak Gopaldas this evening. Ronak, thank you. He is a director and an Africa analyst at Signal Risk on the line to us from London tonight. Yeah, really interesting stories as this continent evolves and changes and as the pressures come to bear of real economies and real people and young people feeling increasingly marginalized. The risks are high, not only in South Africa, but across this continent too. And if economies aren't growing, if people aren't getting opportunities, then it calls into question the system and whether the system works for enough people. And we're seeing that question being asked across many, many economies in the world at the moment, not just on this continent, but this is the one we live on, and this is the one that should concern us most. It was useful and helpful and interesting getting the insights this evening of Ronak Gopaldas, the director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk. Well, it's been a while since we talked cryptocurrencies, the industry undergoing a very significant credibility crisis with all of the hype-fueled mania that pushed Bitcoin to $20,000 a coin, and lots of people got in at just the wrong time, just as the hype cycle was reaching its peak. And since then, interest in cryptocurrency seems to have plummeted, fallen off a cliff. I wonder if that is the experience of tonight's chief executive at Luno, Marcus Swanepoel, who joins us. Marcus, give us a sense of the state of the cryptocurrency, which never seems to be too far away from at least some skillet or scandal at various points. How are things going in the world of crypto in 2019?
Hi, Bruce. Good to be back. Yes, I think I literally just got off a plane from San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And I think when we look at the crypto industry, it's important for people to kind of take a step back and look at the longer term view and what exactly is going on. Strangely enough, I think the sentiment for the industry, certainly by the insiders in the industry and a lot of other players, is actually the highest it's been in many, many years. I think there's a bit of a fixation always on the price. And of course, the price is one data point of traction in the industry. But that cycle that you mentioned, we've seen at least 13 of those cycles up, down, up, down. But if you take a step back and you look at what's happened over the last 5 to 10 years, really, it's actually been a tremendous success from an adoption point of view, from a scaling point of view. Of course, there's always going to be short-term growing pains with any new technology. So we're very optimistic, to be honest.
But the hype cycle reached epic points. I mean, previously when, you know, Bitcoin went from $1 to $2, and then from $2 to $4, from $4 to $8, from $50 to $100, nobody really noticed. But suddenly, it was as if, I don't know, the world woke up one morning and decided that this was going to be the new elixir of financial freedom.
And it might still be the new Alexa of financial freedom. I think it's a bit too early to tell. But you're right. I think what really happened in that last cycle is the media really supercharged it. I think there was so much interest and so much talk about it that everywhere that you went and you looked online or on a newspaper or listening to a radio show, watching TV, everyone was talking about it. And I think that just fueled the hype. even at the time, we were very worried because we said, look, it's just way too much hype. You know, this is a limb experiment. This is going to take 10 to 20 years to really go through. So you're right. The last one was very supercharged. But again, it's pulled back now. It's, you know, still at a level much higher than it's been the last few years. And again, you know, for people, for example, at Luno and other crypto companies, we tend to not even look at the price because what we want to build in the long run isn't enough price. Of course, in the short run, these things matter. But it's the same with the shares of a company. You know, you are going to have some fluctuations and eventually it will approximate the value of the company itself in the long term.
What are you building? What is Luno? It's a crypto exchange. And for many people, they've already switched off going, I don't want to hear about that. But explain to us, those of us who are still here, what this notion of the crypto exchange.
So I think, you know, again, taking a step back, we, you know, never mind crypto. We think a lot about how people are going to be thinking and using money in the next 20 or, you know, 10 to 20 years time. And, you know, we think money is going to be a lot easier to move around. Value is going to be a lot easier to transfer, free. Systems will be a lot more interoperable. So I can catch a Pokemon Go and immediately sell it on Takealot and buy something on Alexa or a VR headset. And that interoperability also extending not just to the systems humans use, but also to machines. So if you have a self-driving car like a Tesla, if that's going to be communicating to your home with your home or with your Alexa, why wouldn't they be transacting with each other? So people like to talk about banking the unbanked when it comes to cryptocurrency. But for us, the unbanked doesn't mean a billion poor people in emerging markets. It also potentially means trillions of devices that need to be connected to the financial system. And I think, you know, there's a long laundry list of things that, you know, we think that money can become better. And interestingly, when you speak to most banks, even regulators and certainly fintech companies, people tend to agree that about that fuzzy future, about a better way to do money. Where people tend to disagree a little bit is how are we going to get there and how long is it going to take? And so there's various approaches. Amazon are trying, Google are trying. You have challenger banks in the UK. You have all kinds of interesting companies starting off somewhere trying to build that kind of end vision. And we're doing exactly the same, except we've chosen cryptocurrencies, decentralized cryptocurrencies, as our main tool to get there, because we think that if the financial system is going to become more optimized and better, it's probably going to be through a new technology and not the existing system reinventing itself. So just to summarize, our vision is to upgrade the world to a better financial system. We're not building an investment company or gambling company. We think people will use this in their everyday lives just like they use normal money today. But right now, we're focusing on just making it really easy for people to buy, store, use, and learn about cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum. And the learning element, as you rightly point out, is it's a big problem. The industry just assumed everyone would understand what Bitcoin mining is and transactions and cryptography. And so I think there's a lot of work to do just to help educate people about what really is going on here and that it's not about gambling and speculation, but it's about building a more robust financial system for the next 20, 50, 100 years.
Where are you basing Luno? I mean, I know it's in the cloud somewhere, but where are you domiciling in the real world, Luno?
So we have operations in many different countries. Our customers are actually in about 40 countries. But our head office is in London. We've got an office in Singapore. We have a big team in Cape Town. We've just launched a team in Johannesburg a couple of months ago. And also smaller teams in Lagos, Jakarta, and Kuala Lumpur. So just like Bitcoin is very global, our team is also pretty global.
What do your teams do? I mean, what is their job? What, I mean, one would think that in the world of crypto exchange, cryptos are created, mined, and then go into people's wallets. What is it for human beings to do?
So there's a lot of work to do. And as you know, a lot of it comes down to the education part that you mentioned. So a lot of, obviously, most of the company are software engineers. We've got some of the most talented engineers in South Africa working for us that build the products so that you can download the app and you can buy and sell. And a lot of that work going into making sure that it's stored securely. So that's a big chunk of the company. But also another big chunk is customer success. And this is people helping people help, you know, learn about cryptocurrency, but also when they have problems, when they don't understand how it works and so on. And I think that's the important part. You know, if it's such a new technology, people still want that human element and someone to talk to. And so we've, for example, launched live chat so that in the product you can chat live with someone to help you along the way. So we sometimes think of it as akin to a spaceship that, you know, is about to go to the moon and everyone you know, you're a customer and you're kind of excited to go to the moon, but you're also a little bit scared. And so we have this technology and product team that build the ship itself. And then we have the team that kind of help people that are like the stewardesses or the stewards on the flight. And we say, come with us on this journey. We'll help you. Yes, this plane might shake a little bit. We might lose an engine here or there, but we'll get there safely in the end. And that's what we do.
Are you a South African company or you a global company? What are you?
We're a global company, so depending on which part of the operations, will depend on where that is. But a lot of people are in London and South Africa and Singapore.
Okay, you are South African. Yes. You are the chief executive at Loon, the founder. You've worked in private equity. You've worked in investment banking and consumer banking on different mm-hmm. continents. You worked at Standard Chartered, Morgan Stanley. You've got an MBA. You're a chartered accountant. You are a chartered financial analyst. Couldn't you get a proper job?
I think in hindsight...
That was so horrible. Sorry. My Tourette's kicked in. Yes.
It's okay. But, you know, I think South Africans tend to obsess a little bit about degrees and things behind their name. And I think we inherited that from the Germans. And so when you're young, that's the type of things that you care about. But I guess I'm curious and I'm inquisitive and I've always wanted to learn more about finance and money. And at the same time, I was interested in technology since an early age. So that's all kind of just culminated together. But I think, you know, the one thing, you know, you mentioned the Bitcoin price as kind of a measure of the industry. The other thing that people don't see is the quality of talent coming into our industry. And the amount of people that are from the top companies in the world. I mean, we're hiring people from Google and Amazon and the top fintech companies in Europe and big law firms and big banks all over South Africa and Europe and Southeast Asia. And when that big wave happened, you saw a lot more talent coming into the industry. But the interesting thing is, even after the price subsided, that wave of talent kept on coming in. And even when I was in Silicon Valley last week, it's the employer of choice for many young, smart people. So if you use human capital as a proxy for success in the industry, then things are really being set up for success because you have some of the best people in the world that are getting together, rallying around this mission and really wanting to change things. And that in itself is creating a lot of momentum.
How good are we, I say we as in South Africans, in the world of crypto, in the world of tech, in the world of code? You say you've got a big operation in Cape Town, you're starting up in Gauteng as well. I mean, do we box against the best?
I think at a very high level, we're very, very small. If you compare us to Silicon Valley or to London and even some parts of Southeast Asia. But there are certain subsectors that showing a lot of promise and that we are probably out-batting what we should be batting at. And that would be, fintech is a good example. I think a lot of people like to build financial products in South Africa. And interestingly, in the crypto/blockchain industry, there definitely we've seen a completely outsized representation of South Africans that are successful in the industry. There's, people like Vinnie Lingham building successful companies in Silicon Valley. We have people like Fluffy Pony, who's one of the founders of
who?
Of Monero. Ricardo, his nickname his Twitter
Fluffy.
Handle is Fluffy Pony.
But
he lives in South Africa, but he's, you know, when that guy arrives in Silicon Valley, you know, he's treated as a celebrity. There's a few other crypto companies as well. And so interestingly, you know, cryptocurrency is overrepresented in South Africa. Some of them are in South Africa, some of them are in Silicon Valley, some of them are in Europe. But certainly there we packing a big punch.
How many crypto sort of what are you, crypto storage facilities, crypto banks, crypto, what are you?
Well, we also help people store
platforms.
Their crypto.
I mean,
yes, platform is a nice word.
Well, how many crypto platforms are there in the world? Are there 100, 1,000, 10,000?
There's my guess is there might be in the thousands. Ones that are considered good and safe, I would say, are in the tens, maybe. Yeah, maybe like 20 or 30.
What makes a crypto platform safe?
It's a combination of a lot of things. A lot of it's internal, so it's very hard to see it from the outside. But the proxy that one typically takes for that is look at the quality of the team, look at who the software engineers are, who are the investors in that company, have they had any incidents, you know, with security before, and so on. So if you take all of those things and you look at, you know, who's raised good funding, who have good investors, who have strong teams, then the list becomes very short. And of course, there's, you know, only a few that are very global, like Luno, and those tend to be the ones that, you know, over time people aggregate to. We also, you know, do a lot of compliance, and we make sure that we have the right regulatory frameworks. And so what you over time, you know, when we met the first time, I think a couple of years ago, 2015, you interviewed me just after we raised some money from NASPERS. I would say then it was really the Wild West and people were all over the place. But over time, as we've kind of built more high quality products and services, you've seen that customers concentrating again around these high-quality platforms, and that's been very good for the industry.
I remember asking you then, what do you pay your staff in? And you said rand, yes, and dollars. And I was like, well, if they really believed in this, they'd be paid in bitcoins. Has anybody get paid in crypto yet?
They keep on asking, and I would love to, but the only reason we don't is it just complicates tax matters, because in many countries, people want to declare their Bitcoin for tax, but there's literally no way on the form to put it. So it's just a little bit too complicated. So until some tax authorities, and we are seeing some in some countries, say, look, if you are going to get Bitcoin as an income, this is how you're going to declare it, this is where you can put it on the form, then we'll definitely start doing it. But right now, it's better just to go the old-fashioned way.
Regulatory frameworks. I mean, how regulated is the world of crypto?
So it's mostly unregulated, with the exception of maybe New York and a few other smaller countries. There's been some movement in the Philippines, Thailand, and so on. And again, you know, when people say the word unregulated, some people get a bit worried and they think that means illegal or there's something wrong. And it doesn't mean that. It just means the regulation hasn't been put in place. And, you know, over the last 5 years, we've been spending a lot of time with regulators all over the world, trying to educate them, working closely with them, understanding what their needs are. And in that, during that time, we self-regulate because we know that the industry will get regulated eventually. So we tend to self-regulate similar to banks. We have similar controls that banks have in place, with some additional controls because we have cryptocurrency. And over time, you will see some countries starting to put actual frameworks in place. The interesting thing that's happened is that, you know, there were one or two countries that said, look, we don't understand this. If we can just regulate it under an existing framework, let's say for remittances or for banking or whatever. But the smarter countries have said, look, we don't really understand this thing. One day it looks like a payment system, the next day it looks like a commodity, the next day it looks like something else. So why don't we just wait and just see where this whole thing comes out? As long as you do good KYC and AML checks, we're going to be happy. And then over time, we will put the right framework in place. And there's a few countries that have those frameworks in the pipeline. And probably over the next year or two, we'll see. I mean, certainly we'll have about 3 or 4 licenses over the next 2 years. And in 5 or 10 years, I'm pretty sure there will be licenses for crypto in all countries around the world.
What are the vulnerabilities of these platforms? Because there's a story out of Canada fairly recently, quite a big scandal, Canadian firm. The founder died, 30 years old, and he died with the codes in his head. Nobody had written these blooming things down. I think when they managed finally to crack some of the wallets where cryptos were supposedly stored, a lot of the wallets were empty. That sort of PR is not good for you or the industry as a whole.
Yes, it's very unfortunate because if I can put that in perspective, if, you know, the size of our operations and our company, it's similar to someone walking down the street and they have an option of walking into a big bank like Standard Bank, or there's someone standing with a table outside saying, do you want to not rather trust me with your money? And then someone going and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to give you the money. And that's the difference between the scale of operation. So it's unfortunate that that company managed to get people to trust them to give that money. Because the way we store the keys and most of the other big crypto platforms is with processes that are completely independent of individuals or people having to remember things. These, you know, I think I explained last time, but the one, you know, big surprise for a lot of people about cryptocurrency, even though it's meant to be this, you know, online currency for the world, most of it is actually stored offline. And we store it offline in bank vaults on multiple continents. And it's a bit like in the movies when someone wants to fire a nuclear weapon, you need these, you know, multiple access codes, and they bring all the codes together and then they pull three or four switches together. It's similar to that. You can't just have access to one vault. You need to go to multiple vaults and bring all those keys together. And that's how you can actually access the crypto. So it's very sophisticated stuff that we and other platforms do. It's just a little bit unfortunate that everyone doesn't do it like that. But again, you know, I think over time people will do a lot more due diligence and this, these things. I mean, it's already happening a lot less than it happened like 3 or 4 years ago.
And this time last week, I was chatting to Kim Reed at Takealot, and they're 8 years old and they still haven't made a profit. Are your funders deep pocketed and patient?
They are very deep pocketed and very patient, because we all know this is a very long term journey. But at the same time, we run a very, very lean operation. In that sense, we operate more like Amazon. And so we haven't actually been that pressured. We've had quarters where we've turned a profit. And you know, we take that money and we reinvest it immediately into building better customer experience and better products and so on. So the business model is actually very, very sound. And, you know, it's a very different business model from like the likes of a Uber or e-commerce. You know, it's not a commoditized product. People aren't shopping just on price. People shop on trust and reliability. So I think it's a very different business model than you see from some of these big Silicon Valley companies that needed to raise billions and billions to achieve their goals. With us, we don't need that much money to kind of build what we need to build.
Do you still have Naspers in your funding stable?
Yes, they're still one of our larger investors.
And what's their game? I mean, are they invested in crypto in other parts of the world? Are you their only crypto play that you're aware of?
They have also invested in other companies. I know what has been publicly disclosed. They invested in a crypto company in the Philippines. They've actually since sold that business to a really really good acquirer, and they've also invested in something called Bakkt. Bakkt is really it's the New York Stock Exchange and that have actually opened an institutional grade Bitcoin market that they're going to launch later this year, and that's a very exciting
institutional grade Bitcoin market. It's the first bit of jargon you've used that I've lost you on.
Okay, so one, there's a lot of interest from large institutions to participate in Bitcoin. And when I mean large institutions, I mean things like big endowment funds in the US, big hedge funds, because a lot of people see it as an asset class that they want to participate in. But for many of them, it's very hard to access it. Like a big, you know, a $20 billion hedge fund is going to struggle to kind of download the Luno app and then, you know, buy billions of dollars of Bitcoin on Luno. And so they need platforms that can handle those volumes, but at the same time also platforms that are regulated. So it's easier for them to trade on something that they already know, something like the New York Stock Exchange, or for example with Fidelity. Fidelity works with a lot of these customers, and they've just launched a storage solution for cryptocurrency. So that's really an entirely new market segment that things like Bakkt and Fidelity are going to open up with huge amounts of money sitting on the sidelines that want to come into this industry. And that's a very exciting prospect for the industry over the next few years.
Kristen Benoni says, when I Google the price of Bitcoin, the price appears to be quite a lot lower than quoted on the Luno platform. Why is that?
So it depends on which country. I'm assuming he's looking in South Africa. So first of all, when you Google even, you know, a normal exchange rate, what you see on Google is not what you're going to see at the airport. So there are differences. The price in South Africa tends to trade at a slight premium to other markets, and the most common answer for that is that it's probably because of capital controls. So, you know, the price people tend to arbitrage the Bitcoin price all over the world and buy in one country and sell in another country. But because it's a little bit difficult to move rands in and out of South Africa, you tend to see a little bit of a premium in South Africa. And that's the most reasonable explanation we found, and we believe it to be the case.
Chris, I hope that answers your question. You've raised $13 million since you launched in 2015. That's proper money. That's 200 million rand or thereabouts. You've had an A and a B round. You've got 2 million customer wallets, or 2 million customers, individual customers, in 40 countries. Are you in line to be a gorilla in this industry, do you think?
Well, we're planning to build a platform that a billion people will be able to use by 2030. So the ambition is very high. And, you know, there's very few industries in the world that can legitimately even think of things like that. If you are in e-commerce or you know, ride sharing. I mean, you have to build all this infrastructure, physical infrastructure and so on. So for us to say, look, we want to build something of massive scale to really improve people's lives, that's a very realistic thing to do. So that's the ambition. It's very big. But having said that, we're very much at the early stage of the journey. A lot of people talk about crypto almost as if it's done, or it's we've seen it all, and we're really just at the start of this entire industry and all the innovation that's going to come with it. So yes, the ambition is very high, but we have a long way to go. But we have, you know, a team of over 200 people that are super passionate about the industry and about our customers, and working really hard every day to make that dream a reality.
Marco Swanepoel, lovely to have you again. Thank you so much for coming in. Chief Executive at Luno, a growing cryptocurrency platform, South African origins, but globalized, and doing some very interesting things. Thank you for explaining it to us. Marco Swanepoel at Luno.